Now I'm really going to move on, pretty largely kind of past Edwards into stuff that I'm not deriving directly from him, more from my experience, conversations Mark and I have been part of for years. And really, I think, Mark, your comment is probably explaining it. It's the way we've discovered God backwards. In very surprising places, and you end up with a bigger God, which is fantastic. Anyway, so
I mean, in my case, and obviously I did, all the study anybody ever does, the normal direction, the more interesting stuff's all been working backwards.
Yes, absolutely. So, okay, let's just. So the second thing is, what's our role in all of this, process of amplification? That's my question. What's our role in the process of amplification? And so, we have our little model here that was the Trinitarian model of a, dynamic creating system that where amplification is the goal of God, the communication of his essence, as Edwards has expressed so wonderfully. The critical question now becomes the special role of humanity in the process. And this now gets on, I think, awesome, edgy, scary, wondrous ground. Because I'm going to have to describe a role of sub-God. The only way to describe this role is we are like God. And I had the privilege when I wasn't regent of going to a lecture on the Saturday by Jens Zimmerman, who's a professor, regent graduate, but a professor, and he gave a wonderful lecture on humanism and the humanist tradition, stunning and very important. We must sit down and talk about it. It's very important. But he answered a question for me, which I have always wondered about, and I couldn't really, I suspected, but wanted a clear answer. I'm very involved in trying to, a project of what we call saving the humanities. The humanities, the study of literature, philosophy, history is very much under threat in the world today. Funding is being reduced at universities all over the world. Whole departments are collapsing because it's not relevant. It's the drive for professional vocational education is dominating everywhere. In other words, if there isn't a job at the end of it and there isn't a career at the end of it, why are you studying Latin? Why are you studying Greek? So there is a tremendous academic competition to be relevant. And of course, the humanities are big losers. What's the relevance of Hamlet? Why study it? So I'm with Professor Will Christie, who's the Professor of English at Sydney University, where organising a counter-revolution, and it's not even confined to Australia. I think it's very, very important. I won't go into the details, but that's my heart. My heart is poetry and literature. That's where I've kind of. But my question is: to what degree are the humanities intrinsically indebted to the Christian tradition? That was my question to Jens. To what degree is this, very noble career of the humanities? I'd always suspected there's something deeply spiritual in the battle. I've always expected there was something dark about getting rid of it. And all we can study is computer programming and go work in call centres. I've always thought this is not, there's something dark about it. That's my feeling. It's not good, and it's a dehumanising influence. So this was my question to Jens, which I did not have the history to answer, but his answer was unequivocally yes. The lecture he gave demonstrated it, and he's written a book. And I wouldn't pretend that I could summarise what he said, but I could read a couple of quotes that he gave, which were from the patristic fathers or some people in the tradition of Christianity. He well, Clement of Alexandria, who declared the gospel was much more than the forgiveness of sins and so on. The goal was to restore you to the original model, so you, God is speaking to humanity, to restore you to the original model so you can become like me. God speaking, you can become like me. I didn't prepare this, sorry, so that's why I'm just having to scratch around and look for it, but God became human so human beings could become like God. And St. Basil the Great, who said the goal of Christianity is that we might assume likeness to God as far as is possible to human nature. So, and the general topic that they used the phrase, this is the early church fathers, the deification of humanity. So our role is so glorious that we are this far from the Godhead. And Edwards was very much of this camp as well. They took the phrase partakers of the divine nature. So Jens's answer was that this whole tradition dignifying human beings made the humanities possible, which is, you know, which is a glorious thought. So let's get into it just quickly. Now, I'll go through this, I hope, a little bit more quickly, but I want to do it justice. So my question becomes, what is God's chosen mechanism for enlargement? Edwards has established this is his goal, infinite enlargement. What's his chosen modus operandi? And the answer is, it is not mechanics. It's not gravity, it's not an ever-expanding universe. And it's not the forces of nature. And it's not the instinctual forces of animals. So this is not intrinsically God's chosen modus operandi of enlargement. It is not a mechanical expansion. Does this make sense to you? Nor is it an instinctual expansion. His chosen expansion is via, this is my phrase, my renaming of human beings, Trinitarian agents. In other words, mini gods who will infinitely expand his kingdom. They are agents, in other words, they are sources of cause. They are sources of initiative. They are sources of action. But they have within their nature the same Trinitarian structure that God does, which is not shared by any other element of creation. The Trinitarian faculty is not shared by animals, by the wind, by gravity, by the flora and fauna. It is not shared by any of these. Magnificent as they are, we are imago Dei, made in the image of God. And I think what I'm just trying now to amplify that is that in essence, the image of God is we share the Trinitarian faculty. Now, this is God's chosen mechanism. Now, that is point one. Point two is, why would he be so intent on choosing such an instrument? Why not the wind? Why not ever-expanding universe? Why not mechanical forces? Why? Why is he saying, my major mechanism, my complete commitment, the weight of all I have will be on Trinitarian agents. Why? Because this amplification is not to create an impersonal universe. He is not interested in rocks getting bigger. He is not interested in wind blowing in more places. He is interested in a universe impregnated with personhood. That is what he's interested in. It goes back to this magnificent phrase we had on the board here. Thus the whole universe, in all its actings, proceedings, revolution, and entire, in all it is doing, all of its mechanisms, what is it doing? It is animated and directed by one common soul. And the mechanism for that animation are other souls who share the common soul of God. He wants a utterly personalized universe. Now, this is rather a breathtaking vision. And you've got to get practical about it, because it looks at the moment like there's a long way to go, right? In other words, in our present state, the degree of amplification that I might have looks rather small for such a grand vision. I hope, you know, by the time I just quickly go through, I hope to explain why this is, even in our present mortal state, actually not true. But the full expression of all this, where this is no fairy tale at all, is when the resurrection power of Christ will be unleashed through all the redeemed humanity. And my faculties will match those of Christ. So get used to it. You're going to govern probably planets and cosmoses. You won't have little sandpits, you'll have big sandpits. So that's the ultimate goal. That literally, this will be literally true. Who knows? Perhaps there'll be many Earths, and we'll rule solar systems when we share the faculties of Christ. This is entirely likely. Okay, and the link between where we are now and this future is the resurrected Christ and the glorious power that we share. That will unleash all this. It won't change our Trinitarian nature, though. It will resurrect it and amplify and generate. It won't change it. We don't have to get another nature. We don't become some other alien creature to do this that we're not now. Does that make sense? There is tremendous continuity and discontinuity in this vision of Trinitarian agents. So this is his goal, that the whole universe would be personal. Now, I said I'd move sideways from time to time to explain how this affects my life on a daily basis. So going back to the conversation we had, sorry, I've already forgotten, Monica and I had. So for this reason, Monica, that is one of the reasons why I deny merely mechanical and objective targets for my clients. You know, God's principle everywhere is not a mechanistic view of the organization, it's a humanized view. God's vision of an economy is not demand and supply, it is human beings. Everything has to be personalized. So the humanizing of products, services, and organizations is the goal. God's ultimate goal of an organization is not a machine, which is, for those of you who've studied management, would know the dominant metaphor that the 19th century created for the organization was a machine. And does anyone know the phrase that human beings got called in the machine? Monica, you know. What are we?
Resources.
We're resources. Yeah, what more contemptible phrase could you imagine? Hands up those who want to fall in love with a resource. It's a terrible phrase. And as a sign of, you know, really good clients, one of the great clients I worked with, who was then running Hammersley Iron, when I made that comment to him, immediately, he ordered the name of the HR department to be changed to the people department. And they did. But it wasn't just a good idea. It was from then on in the people department, people systems. Oh, what a terrible phrase. So that's an example of a worldview that is very dominant, right? And it's not just phraseology. You know, I had a conversation recently with a man who runs a multi-billion dollar part of Microsoft who wants to leave, and he said because Microsoft treats their employees like shit, quote unquote. Steve Ballmer's just got voted the worst CEO in America. top 100s, Fortune 100, worst in America. Largely because of the toxic tweeting going on about what it's like to work at Microsoft. You know, it is a dehumanizing company. So, is that going to make you feel, despite the fact that you're worth mega $100-200 million and the company's making, you know, mega amounts of money, does this feel good? No, because he's going for that. It's a machine that makes money rather than, no, the ultimate, the responsibility of these Trinitarian agents is to humanize everything. It doesn't mean that you run a charity. It doesn't mean that you can't make a profit, but it does mean you pay attention to people. This gets very practical. So, Trinitarian agents, why to create a personal universe, and the vision of God, you know, as that every crevice of creation is then filled with the Spirit. Now, I will now go on to say the obvious, which is we now need to get into what these qualities of Trinitarian agency are in us. But suffice it to say this, I just want to give you a taste. He wants this growth to have these sorts of flexion points everywhere. It's deliberate growth. It's deliberate growth with choices made. He doesn't want replicators. Now, without going too far, I mean, one of the points John Walton made about the gods of the ancient Near Eastern world, he said they distributed their authority. The God of Moses delegated. He kept authority, but he delegated decision making to people. So this replication is not some automatic amplification. It's actually moments of choice and decision. This growth will be deliberate. This is a huge responsibility. Every one of those little bubbles will have myriad choices to make in their life. And God's not going to make the choice for us because he doesn't want that. He wants a universe that's personal, not impersonal or depersonalized. Our robots won't do it. They have to be conscious agents and deliberate agents. You see what I mean? You can see the goal, you can see why God does it, but the point is that there are now millions of delegated decision points which he's given. And he's not telling us what the answers are. He's wanting us, in our local situation, to amplify the Godhead by interpreting into our particular situation what a wise way to act would be. And the more you read the Bible, you'll find he's not interested in there being a rule. He does not interest God. In all the situations in which the Trinitarian agents, it doesn't interest him. It's not like God has an answer. Now, that is not what he wants. He wants interpretation. He wants you in your situation to interpret into, you know, like a work of art. So these are now myriad works of art. And he's wanting art to emerge, not mechanics. Does this make sense? And the more he's surprised, the better, as far as he's concerned. So the implications of this particular vision for Christians is very important. And I just will just quickly read this out, because this is a big change for me. This is a big change for a lot of Christians. And this says that this is the big message. The heart of the Judeo-Christian message is for all humanity, not just believers. That is the only implication of this. This is not a message for the redeemed. This is a message for the whole world. Now, where exactly we go with that, into kind of where people are redemptively in the future, I don't know. I'm not going to get into that tonight, but there's no question that this message is for everybody, and everybody is participating in it. And there's no question that these Trinitarian agents include people who don't yet know Christ, technically. So I think Cicero was a great Trinitarian agent. I think Plutarch said that of Cicero, and so did Edwin Judge. He was in search of Christ, and Edwin is sure Cicero is in the kingdom of God. Because his decisions, his choices were to withstand the Roman Empire and the imperialism of Caesar and the law of murder and savagery
and stand up for the rule of law. That every human being would have justice. That was Cicero's decision. Cost him his life. Well, I think that's pretty... I think God's going to give a tick to that, right? And in terms of the choices that that person made. So this is the first point. Thus, as Christians believing this, this is a big change for me, we must enact non-sectarian participation for all in the vision. Non-sectarian participation for all in the vision. So let me get practical about this. When I was a younger Christian in the kind of sacred secular split, I thought, and there's a strong view back in that earlier view I characterised of the pipeline, if only Christians ruled the world, wouldn't it be wonderful? I think it could be a disaster. You know, so I went to a conference in Indonesia where there was a lot of examples of these Christians who were moving into the public space. And that was their view. Only Christians ran government. And they gave an example of a small European country. Apparently this country, the churches are organised themselves into a political party post the fall of communism, and they actually took control of government. And they all just thought this was fantastic. You know, we've got a Christian treasurer. You know, who prays? Well, I don't care less. Does he know anything about economics? That's what I want to know. I'd much rather have an atheist who is a good economist than a Christian who knew nothing about economics running the country. Sorry. And to make matters worse, I quickly discovered that some of my heroes were agnostics or atheists. I mean, heroes, I mean people I worked with who had incredible selfless integrity. One of the great ones was a man in Canberra, one of the great leaders. Had a headache every day of his life for 20 years until they discovered what was wrong with it. Can you imagine going to work with a crippling headache, migraine scale, and running a large government department without losing your temper, with all the pain, without, you know, wonderful human being, selfless man, great man. Agnostic. We had wonderful talks about it. Versus I've seen Christians who, you know, I thought were political and self-serving and short-sighted on vision. So when I was a younger Christian, I found that very confusing. Did I pick the wrong side or, you know, what? Because I thought Christians were the goodies and they were the baddies, you know. What's happening here? Well, no, that's not what's happening here. This is what God meant in creation. Our job is to advocate and declare it. We're in the gutter with people, put it under and say, there's hope. We're involved in a great, great task. So this is part of the implications of this. So frankly, any groups of Christians who get this will have to throw out the idea that this is a church implemented program. It's much more light and salt and participation and sharing. It doesn't mean we stop talking about Jesus. It doesn't mean, you know, the great thing is Jesus rose from the dead. Right, this is the declaration of the gospel all remains, but it's within a common framework of really a declaration to people of enormous hope in the tasks we're doing today. Does that make sense? So rather than us being the audit, internal audit, policemen of the universe, we are the declarers of hope and possibility. Of all people, we are the declarers of hope and possibility because we have so much. We believe we're in a bigger game that we didn't start. Okay.
Tony, I think two things that might, I don't know whether it's true for anybody here tonight, but I think in generally speaking, for a lot of Christians for whom this is new to hear, there's two things that probably are blockers to hearing this that need to be sort of, you've hit on both of them, but if I just name them as this, I think, for a lot of people, certainly was how I grew up. It's almost like when I'm outside of Christ, it's like, if I use this language now, it's like I'm not a Trinitarian agent. It would be the idea that, you know, if I haven't yet come to confess Christ as Lord, then somehow I'm not that. Whereas we're saying, no, hang on a minute, you're still a human being, you're still the image of God. That just doesn't change. That's actually who you are. The point is around whether a person confesses the one who stands behind it all, or whether a person doesn't confess the one who stands behind it all. But the fact that you are nonetheless who you are, participating in this, doing what it is that God has always intended, is still the point. So even in the Genesis narrative, in the first 11 chapters, you see, I think, I think Genesis is pretty candid about saying, on the one hand, even after Genesis 3, you've got all sorts of magnificent things that human beings do, the creation of music and culture and building of cities and all the rest of it. And that's all, there's no kind of, is it believing or is it not believing? Mm-hmm. It's just regarded as, here the amplification is unfolding. At the same time, you get a Babel narrative that says, here's where it can go. Here's where it can go
wrong. The amplification can be a bad amplification.
Yeah, yeah. It can come to the point where it is in fact a deliberate attempt to deny who it is who stands behind it all. But we kind of confuse these two things. I think the other that's really important as you pick up their choice is, again, to go back to this idea that I was saying about theology. I think for a lot of people, it's part of this whole thing I've talked about with the two trees and the kind of binary nature of thinking is that we think the role of a human being in creation is just to keep it, you know? Keep it as in...
Static.
Yeah, static. Put a fence around it and do your best to make sure nothing gets mucked up. Rather than this notion of, from the very beginning, it's actually to amplify it. That it was always God's intention that there be hybridization of tomatoes, you know? And musical scales, and we discover and make instruments and blah, 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 you know, and discover principles that allow us to do engineering and carry water from here to there and all this sort of stuff. Versus, I think, the kind of teaching I grew up with, no one ever quite said it, but it was really, really implying that being a human was a problem. Not that we have a problem that is rebellion, but that we are a problem. There's something intrinsically wrong, shameful, has to be apologized for, or something about being human. Whereas this picture is saying, no, 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 no. And that remains true of a person who doesn't confess Christ, as one who does. So we're for me, it was, as you talked about your sense of liberation, one of the ones for me was, and I think you've shared it too, is throwing off this strange thing I'd have to, mental gymnastics I'd have to do to somehow deal with the fact that someone who didn't confess Christ, and in fact maybe worse, had nonetheless produced some magnificent thing. And somehow I'm trying to kind of find a way to kind of almost dismiss it as being magnificent or something, you know, rather than just going, for heaven's sake, you know, this was marvellous what was done, whether it was in medicine or music or art or whatever else.
And then I think that's so useful, Mark. And then I guess evangelism becomes calling people home rather than to a strange city, you know. To this day, my favourite response ever to me sharing the gospel with a woman, with anyone, but this particular woman, and I still don't know where she is with the kingdom of God, but I never forgot what she said, and I might have, forgive me if you've heard it before, but it was just so gorgeous. I talked about Christ, I talked a little bit about some of this stuff, and it was very noisy, it was environment, it was a wedding, you know, so you have these snatched conversations, and I didn't know her that well, she's more a friend of Anne's than mine, and she listened, and then she said, "It sounds like Jesus has confirmed what we always suspected was true. It sounds like Jesus has confirmed what we always suspected was true or hoped was true." You know, rather than this being strange, you know, that what you're telling me, it's like this is almost confirming what we all think. We're made for something bigger. We're, life's meant to be glorious. And it's a real, real... recovery. So this has practical implications. And as I say, don't hear me saying, for instance, that this doesn't mean that, you know, because if you then, you know, with this frame of mind, you first tell people they're sinners, or do you first tell people they're potentially glorious, you know, and you declare to them their goal as to why life is hopeful and important, and they're part of that. So now this message is, you know, is a radical message, but I know that, for instance, just as an example, that Rick Watts has taken some of this even further, I think, because, you know, out of our fellowship, he's picked up a lot of this stuff and gone with it, gone further, and Rick went into the book of John. How many times do you see sin and forgiveness in John? We all know what the dominant theme of John is. It's life and light. It's a declaration to the Mediterranean world that just Jesus has brought life and light. you know, and so now there's a pathway to that of repentance and so on, and I'll come to all of that, not tonight but later on, or one of us will, but nonetheless I think this is the broader context. Now I feel that this would be a good place to stop here, because there's a lot to absorb, and it's getting on, and it's such a glorious but I thought I'd just throw one other big thing at you before you went. This is a theory I've come up, and only I am responsible for this theory, right? But Mark has to share a little bit of it, because the idea did occur to me when he invited me to speak at Laidlaw College, which was semi-successful. I don't know how well it went down, but
there were those who loved you.
There were those.
And there were those who were confirmed that all their fears about me.
Yeah. So on this kind of wonderful picture, because I think it'd be good if we just, what we went on next time is more what I was going to talk about, which is the cognition and the whole cognitive creative process and crawling inside mind and, you know, crawling inside the Trinitarian faculty that makes us agents and so on, and you know, we can amplify that. It's a lot of fun. And Edwards was utterly fascinated by it in his life. The great debate with Locke and Hume over where ideas come from and all this kind of stuff, it's really worthwhile getting into, which gets into the actual nitty-gritty of amplification by Trinitarian agents. Okay, so the role of the imagination, all that sort of stuff. If that interests you, that's what we can really talk a great deal about. Now, but I want to finish with, let's go back to a question I think somebody did ask me last time, which was like, well, so where does sin fit in and the fall and all that? This is all glorious, and, you know, where does that fit in? You know, there's various ways around this. Let me kind of give you a way of fitting sin in that is, I think, true to this picture. So we know that really what we're declaring here, as we should declare, is God's archetypal purpose. You know, in other words, and it's a level up from redemption. Now, not that redemption's not important, but redemption is I'm saved and my sins are forgiven. So the question is, well, why? Why did God save me? And it very quickly becomes, why did he even create me in the first place? So that I could sin and then need to get saved again. You know, so this is the big why question. So we know that, I haven't gone into it, but this is really a Genesis 1 and 2 narrative. And I will go into Genesis 1 a little bit more next time. But we know Genesis 3 came what is commonly called the fall. The fall. That is where sin entered the world and Satan entered the world. Because God has enemies. This God has enemies. I don't pretend to understand where they came from or whatever, but they're cosmic enemies. And I've utterly, all my life, have believed that God has cosmic enemies. Principalities and powers. I think, you know, Paul's description of Ephesians is the most epic. I personally find that is the only way I can make sense of evil and human history. You know, you look at the horror of, let's say, you know, the post-communist revolution, Lenin and so on, and that led to the massacre of 20 million or more, hundreds of millions, but far more than that. You look at Pol Pot, you just look at these, it's like madness grips people. I cannot explain that acceleration of madness by merely mechanical terms of merely human beings. It's like there's a wind of evil that takes off and it's there ready to pounce, rightio. And frankly, it's the only way I can make sense of such epic rolling thunderstorms of evil that characterise all of human history. They really do. And so I don't find this kind of, you know, fanciful or spooky or whatever. It's the only way I can make sense of it. So, personally, absolutely always thought God has big enemies of cosmic proportions that we don't understand and so on. However, so, here is my proposition of the fall, a rewriting of the fall. Let me throw you a few ideas which I'll just, you can think about, okay? Number one, and so the archetype of all of these is Satan, or, you know, evil, the evil angelic demons, right here.
cosmic powers. Let me tell you a few propositions that I actually, these are speculations, just to protect myself, but I believe them. This is where I can go back to the private thing. This is just my private belief. Number one, human beings have superior faculties that they can only envy. Our faculties are superior to Satan. He was not made in the image of God. He's not a Trinitarian agent. So personally, I'm utterly convinced of that. And if you want me to have to prove it to you, scripturally, the proof I often do, which I haven't got time to do now, is take the book of Revelation, and the Revelation is full of prayers. They're essentially the prayers of the church and the prayers of the angelic hosts. Your task, and we want to do it, it's fantastic. This is one of the best Bible studies you'll ever do. Take it to a Bible study, pretend you thought of it yourself, though I think it's great. Your task is to lift out all the prayers, lift them all out, arrange them under the prayers prayed by the church and the prayers prayed by the angels. And they are of two different categories. Anyone know some of the differences? So I'll point them to you. So this is now prayers prayed by the church, the prayers prayed by... Now I know that these are good angels, not bad angels, but nonetheless these points look... Who uses the phrase, not the phrase, the appellation, you, in talking to God? The angels talk of God in the third person. What does that tell you? Who's intimate? Who's the friend? Who shares the nature? The angels, it's an externalized, awesome itness about God.
They're spectators.
They're spectators. The angels are spectators. We're married. We're married. That's a great phrase, Mark. So it begins there, that you can go further, and you actually, the next question is to say, you know, which of the prayers show the greatest insight into the whole operations of God, from creation through to salvation? We know what God is doing. They just declare God's attributes. They say nothing of...
Yeah. We tell the story in our prayers.
Yeah, exactly. We tell the story. So, it's a very strong that there's something in our Trinitarian agency that they don't have. So therefore, that's the case, now I'm speculating, Edwards-like, they lack the quality for amplification. They do not have Trinitarian faculty, so they lack the quality for amplification. If you were Satan and you wanted to mess up God's project, what would you do? What is your only hope?
It doesn't grow. It doesn't amplify.
How? What have I got to do? It's a war. What tactic do I have to follow?
Lie.
I have to kidnap the Trinitarian agents and make them my agents. That's what I have to do.
Why does he have to do that?
He wants to screw God's plans up.
You need warped amplification to do it.
Because this whole modus operandi was through the Trinitarian agents.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to attack that in order to attack the Telos.
In order to attack the Telos, I have to attack, because I'm not, I lack the ability to amplification, I being Satan.
Yeah.
I'm actually not strong enough. If I kidnap them and get a conversation between me and them going rather than God and them, then they will amplify to my ends, not God's ends. Mm. Does that make sense? So therefore, let's not call this the fall, let's call it the takeover. Which is really what was happening. It was the invasion, it was the takeover, in cosmic terms. I'm not saying we didn't fall.
It's a coup.
It's a coup. It's the coup. And it's a brilliant coup.
But we didn't give in.
So therefore, amplification. Now, amplification is very dangerous. God, having given it, can't take it away. He can't take away decision, he can't take away our enormous faculties for our creativity creating the atomic bomb, using technology for bad ends. He can't take that away.
So therefore, what we now have is a battle between what kind of amplification and enlargement. We're in the middle of that. That's why life is a dangerous game. And that's why, you know, in this present battle, we've got a battle between, you know, amplification for good and amplification
for
bad.
It's really funny. I was just thinking backwards again, and I was thinking of the language we use around mergers and acquisitions and that sort of stuff. I think about a hostile takeover. The whole idea of a hostile takeover is merely to have market share. It's never to drive innovation.
It's true. It's actually true. It's going back to the truth. Yeah. Hostile takeover. I can't be creative myself, so I'll kind of steal the game from someone else.
Steal the game from someone else, so they can't do it.
There we go. No wonder I love organic revenue growth rather than hostile takeovers. Okay, guys, thanks for hanging in. Big topics, and we'll have it all hosted up on the website. We'll put up the slides, and we'll try and find a copy of Jonathan Edwards' essay and put it up as well.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, guys.